Thank you for listening to this audio recording from LimoPlanet 2020 Free the Future. The following talk was presented at LimoPlanet, the Free Software Foundation's annual conference on current issues in ethics, social justice, and technology. For more information on LimoPlanet, visit limoplanet.org/conference. LimoPlanet is a live conference with speakers who often use visual slides in their presentations. We have only selected talks for this audio feed that do not overly rely on visuals, but if you would like to see a speaker's slides, they are available at media.limoplanet.org. LimoPlanet speakers do not represent the Free Software Foundation. As part of our mission to show how important free software is to everyone, we have speakers talking about their use of free software in different kinds of political and commercial work. The FSF supports their freedom, but does not take positions on any political issues other than those necessary to uphold the principles of free software. Like all the FSF's work on behalf of the freedoms of all computer users, LimoPlanet is made possible by thousands of individuals who, like you, donate what they can. To keep this work going, please consider becoming an associate member via my.fsf.org/join or making a donation at my.fsf.org/donate. You can stay informed by subscribing to our newsletter, The Free Software Supporter, at fsf.org/fss.
Hello, this is Room Monitor Bob. We're about to begin Patents and Freedom, Where We Stand Now. This is presented by McCoy Smith. This session is going to have a Q&A session at the end of the session. We're taking questions via the IRC channel. And we have about 45 minutes for this talk. So thank you for joining us, McCoy Smith.
Okay, thank you. My name is McCoy Smith. I'm coming to you live from my home office in Portland, Oregon, United States of America. I've got a series of slides that I'm going to present from, and we're going to do a little bit of hack on those because we were having some problems presenting from my screen. So I'm going to run them off of my screen, but they may be separately run so you can see them full screen. So let me go over and do my screen share. If I can get that to go. Okay, it's not screen sharing for me, so I'm going to, guys on the technical side, I'm going to run through my slides and just tell you which slide I'm on as a way of allowing you to present what I've got. Does that work? Okay, I'm going to assume that works. I'm going to talk about patents and free software, or freedom in general. Just as a way of an introduction, and the way that us, I'm on slide two now, the way us lawyers typically think is we first come in with a disclaimer. I'm, of course, a lawyer. I'm also a patent lawyer, which is apropos given what we're going to be talking about patents here. But I'm not your lawyer. So we lawyers typically do this anytime we give public presentations and say, listen, if you need legal advice on any particular topic, including about patents, please see your own lawyer if you have legal questions. Your lawyer may have a different opinion on some of this stuff than I do, and it's best to get their legal advice. I've also, for the purposes of this presentation, tried to simplify things a little bit. This area of the law is incredibly complicated and somewhat contradictory. In order to get through this in 45 minutes in a reasonably intelligible way, I've kind of had to simplify things a little bit. So please understand that I haven't gotten into all the details here. These slides are what I'm going to talk about. Also, if you could reserve your questions for the end, usually when I'm live, I can do those as we talk, but given we're using an IRC channel here, And we're working over a video as well. It's probably better for me to go through all of these slides before anybody starts presenting questions to me. I'll try and answer as many as I can in the time that we have at the end of my presentation. So I'm now on slide 3. This is a quotation about software and patents. Probably a lot of you are familiar with this one. If you aren't, the quotation comes from a document that I would hope some of you are familiar with, which is the GPL. GPL, in its current instantiation version 3, talks about the concern with patents around software, and it has said that since at least 1991, GPL v2 had slightly different language, but again, raised concerns about patents on software. So this has been an issue that has been of concern for people working in free software for almost 30 years. Okay, so now I'm going to talk for about 20 minutes about just the basics of what patents are and patents as they relate to software. I am a U.S.-based lawyer, so I'm going to focus primarily on U.S. law, although I'll talk a little bit about the law in other countries as well, but as a way of demonstrating some of the issues here, talking about the U.S. is illustrative. So up at the top of slide 5, which is where I'm on now, is the citation to the U.S. law of patents describing what is patentable. And as you can get from looking at that, it's incredibly broad. Now, what has happened as there has been some clarifications on the breadth of that through some Supreme Court decisions, U.S. Supreme Court decisions, over a number of years, and the U.S. Supreme Court has said there's three important exceptions to the breadth of what can be patentable in the United States: laws of nature, physical phenomena, or abstract ideas. Now, abstract ideas is the important exception here when we're talking about software. I'm going to slide 6 now. So for the past approximately 40 years, there has been an ongoing debate in the United States, as well as overseas, but primarily in the United States, about to what extent software innovations or improvements are abstract ideas that you can't get a patent on, or are something more than an abstract idea which you can get a patent on. And that debate has been going on at all levels of the U.S. court system for quite some time, and it's also a very vigorous debate amongst patent lawyers that has been going on for a long time. Now let's talk a little bit about the history of software and patents. Software patents have been around for a long time. At least since the mid-60s. So I think there is a belief that the first patent ever issued on a software innovation is the one I've identified here. It's 3,380,029, issued in the mid-60s. There may have been earlier ones. It's a little difficult, and it a little bit depends on what you define as software. But they've been around for a long time. I worked at the U.S. Patent Office in the mid-80s. And by then, there was a very, very extensive collection of software patents in the United States. Now, for about 10 years or so, this didn't become an issue through the courts, but the U.S. Supreme Court in 1972 first addressed the issue of whether or to what extent software is patentable in the United States. A case called Gottschalk v. Benson is one of the more important Supreme Court cases in patent law. It related to a technique for converting binary coded decimal numbers to pure binary. And in that case, the U.S. Supreme Court said, that's really not something that you can get a patent on in the United States. that is something that we would classify as a ineligible abstract idea for which patent protection is not available in the United States. Now, since that Gottschalk decision in the early 70s, the Supreme Court has revisited this issue of software and patents and the question of abstraction in a number of different cases, and I'm going to go through several of those with you now. The next one is from the early 1980s. It's called Diamond versus Deere. And this is one where there was a patent that had a little bit more than just software itself. It was a computer used software to process a known mathematical formula, so a formula that had been in existence before this invention. But it had a new configuration of the way the machine collected data to feed into the computer to use that mathematical formula. And in that case, the U.S. Supreme Court said, well, there's more here than an abstract idea, and you can get a patent on that. So you can see here, this one's a software plus other stuff. And in that case, the Supreme Court said, well, there's more here than abstraction, and in this case, we will validate the fact that you can get a patent on this. Okay, so there wasn't a lot of action in the U.S. Supreme Court between the early 80s and the early 2010s. But then in the 2010s, there were actually two fairly important U.S. Supreme Court cases relating to software and patents and this concept of abstract ideas. First one was called Bilski versus Kappos. And this relates to a sort of a separate stream around software patents, which is often referred to as business method patents. This was an area where a lot of people were filing patents in the early 2000s. So Bilski versus Kappos related to a computerized method for optimizing energy trading. And that was found to be unpatentable by the U.S. Supreme Court in 2010. But in doing that and finding this particular patent to be ineligible for patent protection, they said a couple of things. Number one, business method software patents are not ineligible on their own. So there isn't a broad rule that says if you have a patent that involves software to instantiate business method, that's automatically invalid. They also said that software itself that's not tied to a specific machine, like the previous case I discussed, isn't also not per se ineligible. So you could still get a patent on software in this case, they said. They just said in this particular instance that was not patent eligible, this trading method. They also said that the patent law allows you to patent processes, which has been the case for many, many years, and that software fell within the ability to patent processes. So although in this case the patent was found ineligible for patent protection, they did set out some general rules that indicated that in appropriate circumstances, software patents could be pursued in the United States. A couple years later, there was yet another Supreme Court case in around software patents called Alice versus CLS Bank, or everybody calls it Alice in the patent world. This was a patent related to a software-managed financial trading system. Again, a sort of a business method patent, if we're going to categorize these things in that area. This is another one where the Supreme Court said, no, this is an abstract idea and this is not a patent that is eligible for protection in the United States. But they also set out a test that said, if you have an abstract idea and you add what they called another inventive element, that may be patentable. Now, in this case, The Free Software Foundation actually filed a brief, as what we call it, an amicus or a friend of the court, suggesting that they needed to come up with a more concrete test for software patents and that it should be quite narrow. So this Alice case is sort of the one where the industry and many of the people involved around free software had their voices heard and said, hey, we need to get a little bit more clarity on what is and what isn't patentable in the area of software. Okay, since then, the Supreme Court of the United States has not picked up software patents and examined them on this question of abstraction, but there is a lower court called the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, which has done so, and that's the court where most patent cases end up, and the ones that don't go to the Supreme Court. So there are two cases here I wanted to talk about. One's called EnFish. That was a patent relating to a self-referential relational database. That one was found to be valid. That patent was found to be valid by the appeals court here as a non-abstract innovation. The same year and very closely thereafter, there was a separate case, TLI Communications, relating to a software scheme for classifying data on digital images, sending those images to a server, and then storing the images on a server, taking into consideration the classification information. The court in that case found the patent claims to be invalid because they were too abstract. Now, a lot of patent lawyers have a hard time reconciling those two cases. They seem to be somewhat consistent in the sorts of claims that were made and the level of abstraction there. But in this case, you got different results in terms of whether these innovations were abstract or not. Okay, I'm now on slide 12. I'm sorry, I apologize. I have been calling out the slides. So what does this all mean? Well, the courts, at least some of them, and in particular the U.S. Supreme Court, have shown a degree of skepticism related to software patents within the past 20 years. So the ones that were filed prior to the 2010s, particularly the ones that are not particularly technically focused, that tend to be more on business methods and the like, have generally been dealt with a degree of skepticism. And the reason for that is probably the fact that the people who were filing patents back then were doing it with extremely broad claims, not specific to the type of computing device used or particular technologies used in the software, but just sort of broad general principles of doing broad tasks as instantiated in software. And in that case, these courts have generally said, this is too abstract and you're not entitled to a patent on that. However, it is still the case that there are plenty of software developments, if they're detailed more specifically, that'll probably survive the abstraction test that has been set out by the various courts in the United States, particularly the Supreme Court. And what happens in reality in this case is patent lawyers monitor the case law, so the cases that are coming out of especially the appeals courts on this stuff, and they will write the patents and write the claims in a patents in a way to hedge their bets and make sure that they've got a reasonable argument that what they're pursuing here is non-abstract. So basically they write their patents knowing what the decision in Alice was, and making sure that they think they can survive a challenge based on the, the test in that case. Now, I want to talk a little bit about statistics out of the U.S. Patent Office. I've got a link here in my slides. I'm on slide 13. To somebody who did a study and said that patents related to software have jumped from 34% of the patents issued by the U.S. Patent Office in 1991 to 61% last year. Now, I'm a little skeptical of that those numbers there, because defining what is a software patent is really not an exact science. And given that most technologies these days have a little bit of software in them or use software in some way, that they may be over-biasing the statistics there. But I think it is true that the pursuit of software patents has ramped up substantially, particularly since the Supreme Court cases that came out in the early 2010s have at least given an indication to people who want to pursue patents on software that there is room there for them to do that. The reason for the uptick is, of course, patent lawyers are being skillful in the way that they write their software patents. Software, of course, is becoming more important to technology in general and is being integrated in more and more products. So I think you will see, we're seeing an uptick in software patenting, particularly in the United States. Whether it's at the rate that was indicated in that study, I'm a little bit skeptical. Okay, I'm on slide 14 now. So I want to talk a little bit about how patents are evaluated, and we'll start off the U.S. Patent Office. I think you probably understand that the first way that you get the patent process started is you go to the U.S. Patent Office, which is a government agency. You say, I have an innovation here. Please grant me a patent on it. That entity, as indicated by the statistics in the prior slide, has been quite non-skeptical of software patents and has been granting them at a fairly high clip and has been doing so for quite a long time. They are, of course, guided by the Supreme Court decision, so they basically write their review rules based on what the Supreme Court has said. And given what has been said in the case, a case like Alice, they have been following the guidance there, and statistics seem to bear out the fact that they're granting more and more patents related to software. Now, there are two branches you go out from the U.S. Patent Office in the case where a patent is desired to be challenged. One is the U.S. District Courts. So that's a local federal court in the United States. They may or may not be skeptical about software patents or patents in general. It really depends on where you are. If you've been following, if you follow the news in this area, you probably have heard that there are certain courts in Texas that have been perceived as being extremely patent biased towards patents. The Northern District of California, so the Bay Area of California, is probably a little bit more neutral on that, or a little less patent biased than Texas. So depending on where you land in a federal district court in the United States, you may or may not get a skeptical or non-skeptical opinion on the patentability of a patent around software. Now, there's a separate branch to challenge patents, and that's called the Patent Trial and Appeal Board. So that's a part of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, and it's a way to get review of patents that doesn't require you to spend the time and money to get yourself in a U.S. federal district court. They are perceived as being skeptical of pretty much all patents, and they've been characterized by some pro-patent people as the patent death squad. So they've got a close to 50% invalidation rate for patents that people have raised challenges to. And they have become very active because people have perceived them as a cheaper and better way to challenge patents than having to go through the U.S. courts. Above those two entities is a court called the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, which has been called for a number of years the Supreme Court of Patents, because any appeal from a patent case gets fed into that court, no matter where it was filed, whether it was filed in any district court throughout the United States or through the patent office. They get a lot of patent cases. In fact, the majority of what they do is patent cases. And they are probably less skeptical of software patents than perhaps the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court, I talked about a bunch of cases that they do. They do not pick up patent cases all that often. And the fact that they've actually done two software patent cases within the past 10 years is pretty unusual for them. But they tend to look like they're somewhat skeptical of software patents. The problem, of course, is the rules that they have set out for interpreting patents are kind of generic and allow some latitude by lower courts to be skeptical or non-skeptical of software patents. Okay, I'm on slide 15. I'm going to talk about other jurisdictions other than the United States briefly. So the rest of the world, the European Patent Office has some guidelines on software patents. I've replicated them here. They're extremely detailed, but they have a thing called the technical effects test for software patents. Now, I'm not going to recite this. You may want to read through the bolded part of the definition here. This is a test that is about as hard to interpret as the abstract test that we use in the United States. And you will get a debate among patent lawyers which one of these tests, the U.S. test or the European test, is more liberal for software patents. I think generally the Europeans are less liberal on granting software patents, but that may depend a little bit on the skill of writing your patent in order to take into account this technical effects doctrine that they apply to software patents. If you look at slide 16, which I've advanced to here, they do point out that things sort of like software business methods, so how a computer program with how a human being would perform a task, they tend to be skeptical of or outright hostile to as part of their doctrine. Okay, I'm on slide 17 now. So other places in the world on software patents, there are at least two jurisdictions, India and New Zealand, who have set forth in their laws that they are generally anti-software patent. But again, as with most things, that's not a hard and fast rule. And depending on how you present your patent to them, there still may be some latitude for pursuing a software-based patent in those jurisdictions. People's Republic of China, within the past couple of years, has sort of switched on software patents. They used to be very anti-software patent and had some very strict rules for how to get a software patent in China. But in 2017, they updated their rules and made them more liberal with regard to software patents. Part of the reason for that is that the PRC has tried to set itself up as a more patent-friendly jurisdiction than the United States. And in doing so, they wanted to make their rules around software patents be perceived as at least as liberal, if not more liberal, than the U.S. So that's a little bit of international trade and international relations, gamesmanship perhaps going on there around patents. Okay, I'm on slide 18 now. Let's talk a little bit about how you challenge a patent. So if you've got a patent that has been issued by the United States Patent Office, how can you challenge that? So there are basically three components of the U.S. law for challenging a patent as to its patentability or validity. The first is the one that I talked about in the Supreme Court cases. So the abstract question, that is the eligibility section of the U.S. Patent Law, Section 101. But there are two other tests, which are the more common tests for challenging patents. The first is novelty, and that's Section 102 of the patent law in the U.S. And you are not allowed to get a patent if it is not novel. If there is something called prior art that's identical to what you're asking a patent to be granted on. Prior art, what is prior art or is not prior art is a somewhat complicated question, but essentially it means somebody out there before you made public that which you are now trying to get a patent on. Now there's another test, which is probably the most common test that patents are challenged under, and that is called obviousness in the United States, or inventive step in much of the rest of the world. That's Section 103 of the U.S. patent law. And that says, well, there may be prior art that is very similar to what you are claiming a patent for, but is not identical, but what you're pursuing is really not a substantial improvement upon what was there before. It's essentially an obvious extension of what was in the prior art before. And by far, that is the most common grounds to challenge patents, is that it is an obvious extension of existing prior art. So as I said, prior art is by far the most common mechanism to challenge patents. And prior art, at least if you're going to challenge it in the U.S. Patent Office, may be a requirement to do a challenge of a patent. I'll talk about the various venues in which you can challenge patents next. So I'm moving over to slide 19. I talked about before U.S. District Courts in the United States as being a place where you can challenge patents. There needs to be a threat against you in order for you to go to court and challenge a patent there, but you can challenge a patent for any basis you want in the U.S. district courts. The problems with them is that they are very expensive. There's another place to do that, and that's more of an administrative challenge to a patent. So it's called the Patent Trial Appeal Board. There are two ways of challenging a patent in that entity. One is called inter partes review, and to do that, you have to have prior art. So you have to show some sort of public documentation that something existed before the patent that would question whether it's either novel or not obvious. Now, that's still somewhat expensive. The filing fees are $15,000 at least just to get it into the patent office, and legal fees can be much more. But it's substantially easier, faster, and cheaper than going to a U.S. district court. There's also a thing called post-grant review, where you can challenge a patent not only for prior art, but for abstraction. The problem with that is you have to file it very promptly after the patent has issued, which can usually be a problem because there are so many patents issued from the U.S. Patent Office, identifying the ones that are subject to a challenge and that might be a problem is hard. So this is one that not a lot of people pursue because they can't look into a crystal ball and figure out which patents that are coming out or were recently issued are the ones that need to be challenged. All right, so that's the basics of patent law in about a half hour. Now, you're probably asking, okay, that's a lot of interesting legal stuff, but I'm not a lawyer. Gee, what can I do about this problem? I'm on slide 21, by the way. So the last part of this presentation, I'm going to talk about things that you should think about or things that you might want to do. So probably most of you are familiar with Linus's Law. I'm on slide 22. Given enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. I've put a couple of corollaries to that law for patents on slide 23. Given enough free software out there and existent, prior art is shallow. I'll talk a little bit more about what I mean there. And given enough free software developers and free software-friendly patent lawyers, patent design around is shallow. So let's talk about those two corollaries. The first corollary, given enough free software, prior art is shallow. What that means is you know, if you have an infinite number of developers who are publishing free software, you've got an infinite resource of potential prior art to use against people attempting to pursue patents on software. However, in order for prior art to be good, in other words, to be usable to challenge patents, you have to be able to verify the date when it was made public, which is the case for most free software. Of course, it has to be publicly available, which is the case for most free software. But it's also got to be findable, and that may be something that could be improved upon with free software. The biggest need here, I think, to make free software a better resource for prior art challenges is documentation that's susceptible to natural language searching. So just having the source out there and making it public doesn't necessarily mean that somebody who's wanting to challenge a patent is going to be able to find it. Now, if there's sufficient documentation out there describing the feature set of the software, that may help somebody identify software that is useful in a patent challenge. Okay, second corollary here, given enough free software developers and free software-friendly patent lawyers, patent design around is shallow. What I mean here is patents you can think of as a bug, and any bug can be coded around if you have enough resources to do that. Design around is a very common process in the patent world, and the way that it works is the first thing you do is you get a patent lawyer who looks through the record in the patent office of a particular patent, identifies the features that are and are not important in terms of defining the legal rights of that patent, and then gives guidance to people on how to modify a particular piece of technology so that it falls outside of the legal rights of that patent. So in the case of software, you would have a patent lawyer take a look at the patent, look at the patent record, say, hey, if we were to change the software to not do this or to do that, that would have it fall outside of the patent, the rights of the patent. And then the coders are the people who come in and say, okay, let's do what we can to rewrite our software so that it avoids that patent. So what can you do as a non-lawyer? Well, keep writing and publishing free software, and if you have the time, document as much as you can in a way that is easily natural language searchable, so that somebody who may not be familiar with the particular programming language that you're using or the conventions of that programming language nevertheless has the ability to try and find what you've done to identify it as prior art. There's also, also be prepared if it's an opportunity to code around patent bugs. There's also an opportunity, if you're not aware, there is at least one entity called Unified Patents that regularly offers bounties for prior art. And many of the patents that they're looking for bounties on are software patents. So they will, if you subscribe to their Twitter feed, they will announce probably at least once a week, hey, here is a patent that relates to the following technologies. We're looking for prior art that may be useful against it. And they pay somewhere between about $1,000 to $5,000 for people who identify for them prior art that they think is good enough to challenge the patent. So take a look at that if you're interested and you want to make a little extra cash and think that you can identify patents related to particular technologies. They actually put out a bounty for the patent that was asserted against GNOME recently by an entity called Rothschild. So that's one of the few recent cases that actually involved a patent in free software, and a bounty was put out in order to identify prior art for that. Another thing you should think about doing is getting political. There has been a thread of political activity around patents over the past couple of years, where certain entities have claimed that the U.S. patent system has become anti-patent and it needs to be changed. And there's a bill that was introduced into Congress towards the end of 2019 that was designed to change this perceived bias by making things a lot better for patent holders. Probably the biggest concern you would have with this act is it is designed to allow the patent holders to withdraw consent for somebody challenging their patent in the patent office, which you can imagine can be a great problem if you're wanting to challenge a patent. If you have to get the permission of the patent holder to challenge the patent, it's unlikely you're going to be able to challenge the patent, at least through the patent office. They're also trying to get better financial and other remedies for the patent holders and for to allow them to pick patent-friendly courts if they want to assert their patent. So if you make it a habit of writing your congressman, this is something you might want to write them about, because this is being debated right now. There's been a lot of political activity on the pro-patent side. If you think the patent system is too pro-patent now, you certainly wouldn't want it to be more pro-patent. Let your voice be heard. One final thing to think about is standards. There has been a debate going on for the past couple of years around standard setting bodies. As you probably know, a lot of these standard setting bodies have a royalty bearing patent policies. And there has been a debate going on in legal circles about whether it is valid for certain companies participating in standard setting to license code under a license like BSD, yet still reserve the right to assert patents against that code. That's a debate that's going on now. There's a lot of lawyers involved in that. To the extent that you are involved in standards bodies or you're thinking about implementing standards, you might want to look out for uses of BSD code in that standard setting body, because that may be a effort by somebody to reserve the right to assert their patents against you. Okay, so that is all I've got for today. I did have a slide which I didn't have in the ones that you're being presented, but two things you may want to take a look at. One is a book that's coming out this summer through Oxford University Press called Free and Open Source Software, Policy, Law, and Practice. I'm writing a chapter on it, not on patents, but on copyrights, but there's a section in there on patents, actually a couple of sections on patents. So if you're interested in this topic, you may want to take a look out for this out of Oxford University Press. The editor is Amanda Brock. There's also a law journal, actually it's more of an open technology journal called the Journal of Open Law, Technology, and Society, or JOLTS. The website is JOLTS, JOLTS.world. They also publish articles on the intersection of free software and the law, and include patents in that. So you may want to check that out if you have more detailed questions about patents. All right, so we've got about 5 minutes left, and I'm going to switch over to the IRC channel.
We do have a couple of questions from the IRC channel. And why don't I just go ahead and read the first one that I've collected from that, from Robert L. Reed. When in the life cycle of a project should you look for software patents that infringe?
That's a good question. So
we need to keep things moving for time.
Yeah. So I'm not sure that that's something that you should be doing. There is a thing called willfulness that means that if you're aware of a patent and then pursue your technology nonetheless, you can be subject to higher damages. There are different opinions on this, but I'm not sure that searching patents, particularly if you're not a lawyer, is a good idea. if you're going to try and do patent searches against software, please consult with a lawyer. Don't do it on your own.
Okay. And then what is the current success ratio on challenging or trials against software patents?
So I talked a little bit about the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, which has been very, people have been very successful in that entity in challenging patents. I think the invalidity findings have been around 50 to 60%. It's probably higher for software patents. In the court system, it's probably lower, but again, as I said, it depends on where you are, at least in the trial court level. In the appeals court level, you know, the Supreme Court cases I talked about, most of them were disallowing software-related patents, but so you could say that's actually been fairly successful, but I'm not sure that you can extrapolate a trend from that. But it's still relatively successful, particularly on this abstraction question for challenging patents in the courts.
And then maybe as the last 30 seconds here, which is impossible for this question, what are your thoughts on patent left? And then we'll be out of time.
Okay, so you'd probably have to define what patent left is, but let me see if I can define it for you. Patent left would be the idea of dedicating a patent or otherwise licensing a patent freely. Most open source licenses these days do that. They will have a patent grant that says, I grant you the rights to my patents to do everything in this license that is allowed. So that's been around for quite some time. There are other efforts to challenge patents or to dedicate them to the public domain. I think there's actually going to be a discussion about that later today. But this is a good thing.
We'll have to leave it there with that. Thank you very much for your talk. That was an excellent talk.
Okay, thank you very much. And if you have any other questions, feel free. I'll stay on the IRC for a while.